Welcome to Moving the Center. I'm Kali Asad Amen. I have on the phone line Rhonda Ragsdale, Associate Professor of History at Lone Star College in Texas, and she's here to tell us about a wonderful historical documentation project. She's titled The Black Towns Project. Welcome to Moving the Center, Rhonda.
Hello, thank you.
Why don't you tell us what the project is designed to do?
The project is twofold. One part is my dissertation project, which will probably become a book at some point. But my real baby is the online archive and historical preservation project, which is available at blacktownsproject.org. And it is intended to chronicle and list resources for the black towns, what I call historically black towns, of the United States, and to create a place for families and their descendants to connect, to post pictures and information, and for researchers and other people to get information about these towns as well.
So when you talk about black towns, what are we talking about, D.C., Atlanta?
Right. That's one of the first things that people will say is, oh, we had a black town in our town. And what they really mean is a black community. But my project and the larger project looks at autonomous black towns, as autonomous as any town is, meaning they had black leadership, they had black labor sources, a post office, you know, their own functioning community, churches, schools, all of those kinds of things.
When I first heard about your project, I was excited because the experience of folks like these leaders that you talk about, who were really black pioneers in creating these new settlements, represent narratives of black life in America that we seldom celebrate.
That's right.
Well, one of the ways some of us have encountered a notion of these towns, I think, is through African American literature to some extent.
Yes. And
black towns
yes.
have been an inspiration to the likes of Toni Morrison. I think her book Paradise takes place in a black town, and Zora Neale Hurston, of course, with her Dust
right.
Tracks on a Road. And in history class, you never talked about black folks owning their own land, building their own buildings. So this is an incredible contribution. Is there a lot of research about these kinds of towns, or is it sort of scant and fragmented?
Well, when I first started studying this over 10 years ago, I thought it was going to be a real historical excavation project where I was going to be mining these, you know, remote resources. But as I got into it, I realized there is a plethora of information and scholars and resources, but there wasn't a central location for everyone who was studying them to sort of collaborate, gather resources, and talk about them in a meta-narrative. And that's part of what my dissertation project and the website are intended to do, is to create a place where we can gather all of these. Now, I have thousands and thousands of resources on these towns, and it's really amazing. Now I feel like I'm holding back a flood of information once I kind of tapped into what's out there.
Well, and the way you describe the project suggests as well that you're not only looking for archival records, but you expect the body of information about these towns to continue to grow through interviews and oral histories and the like. Is that true?
That's right. And many of these towns are still in existence. They're small rural communities, but they have large family/town reunions, either every year, every few years. And the descendants from these communities, you know, gather and they talk about what the towns were to their families. And it's really a special place when these, just sometimes thousands of people will just descend on a very small town and really have a very special time together.
That's really amazing that the legacies of these towns can really inspire that kind of solidarity and coming together. I want to get into a little bit of the history of the formation of some of these early black towns, and maybe you can give us some insight on that score about how a lot of these towns actually came about.
Sure. As I delved into this, I realized black towns begin when transcontinental slavery begins to take over. as soon as we have the Middle Passage and people being taken so far away from their homes that even if they should escape slavery, they couldn't return to the place of their birth or the place that their ancestors were born. So when they escaped, ran away, they formed communities just outside that slave society. In fact, one of our first black towns is actually in Florida Territory in the 1730s. So these towns are in every stage of U.S. history. They begin that early, and they really continue all through the 19th century.
You know, I appreciate that you reference the transcontinental movement of peoples of African descent in this narrative, because it brings a point to my mind about thinking of black towns from a global perspective. As you were speaking, I'm reminded of the Maroon communities of the Caribbean islands.
Yes.
You know, they, like the black towns that you expose in your project, are these great exemplars of forms of social organization that come directly out of a liberation struggle. And
that's right.
You know, and so for me, learning more about black towns is another way for African peoples in the diaspora to connect with each other and
Absolutely.
Become aware of how our struggles come together in a coherent way.
And not only did these struggles allow a place for refuge for runaways and maroons, as you said, but they become part of the resistance to slavery in the antebellum era. Harriet Tubman, we know for the Underground Railroad, we often advocate her as a great heroine of running away, but people had to run away to somewhere, or that freedom didn't mean much, really, if they're on the move. And she advocated black towns, and I feel very strongly that the black towns in the antebellum era contributed to the weakening and crumbling of slave society in the antebellum South, just as maroon communities did in Central and South America.
They helped to transform the politics of slavery, because there were places where black people could go. There was something they
right.
could look to beyond the plantation. How about you let us know some notable black towns that everybody should know about?
Well, I mentioned Fort Mosé. There's so many, and there's so many interesting stories about them. If you're thinking about antebellum towns, Sandy Ground, New York is a really interesting place, and they have a museum still, and it's very exciting. After the Civil War, and once African Americans in the South realized that Reconstruction hadn't provided the freedom for them that they hoped, the black towns actually developed into a full-blown social movement. And that's when we really see them explode. And it's interesting because that's after slavery. But the conditions of the South remained so poor, with disfranchisement, lynching, discrimination, oppression at every angle, that African Americans in the South felt that leaving, or at least leaving white society, was a nonviolent method of finding a way to empowerment and resistance. So then we get a burst of black towns, and one of the first in that post Civil War era is in Nicodemus, Kansas, where abolitionists, white and black, had already been fighting for freedom and things like that. So that's one that's probably kind of a landmark. But there's also some really interesting and exciting ones. Boley, Oklahoma, was founded in Oklahoma and Indian Territories. It had one of the first black-owned banks. It has some really interesting stories, too. It was a very metropolitan area. Pretty Boy Floyd's bank-robbing gang tried to hold them up, and they ran into more resistance than they expected in Boley, and they were not able to rob their bank. Allensworth, California, which is also a state park, which has been preserved by the state of California, is a great place for families to go. Visit the community, their school curriculum, so school trips could go there. And that community was founded by a former Buffalo soldier, and he intended many Buffalo soldiers to come and retire there.
So the landscape of these black towns is really quite broad. I mean, you're talking all over the map, New York, Florida, Kansas, it goes on and on. And so it's very interesting because you're also kind of exploding our popular conceptions about the roots of black migration. There's just this sprawl, I mean, to hear you tell it and talk about where various groups of newly liberated people settled at. You know, I had no idea that there was such
One of my favorite towns to talk about and read about is Idlewild, Michigan, which I think was loosely based on a film, Idlewild, that Outkast and some other notables were in. And this town was really something special. I mean, everyone was there. Du Bois, Cab Calloway, B.B. King, Louis Armstrong, T-Bone Walker, the Four Tops, you name it. In fact, Madam C.J. Walker, who was the first self-made U.S. woman millionaire of any race, she owned property in Idlewild, Michigan. And the histories are so rich about each one of these towns. It's really a fun thing to look at.
You mentioned Madam C.J. Walker owning property, and that really seems to be quite the linchpin in the opportunity to create these black towns. And for much of our history here, we were not able to own property. Rather, we were the property. So the evolution of these towns comes out of historical conditions related to the conclusion of the Civil War and then, I suppose, the politics of Reconstruction. So in addition to this migration impulse felt by so many Southern blacks at the time, were there particular laws, say, about property ownership or land grants, you know, specific kinds of public incentives that helped to urge these migration processes along?
Actually, the South, right after the Civil War, Southern congressmen became very alarmed by the number of African Americans who were leaving the South. And that in and of itself was a form of resistance. They actually had a special Senate committee on the exodus, they called it, of the South. And they were concerned, why are all of these people leaving? Maybe it's the conditions.
And we're talking like 1866 through the 1870s or thereabouts.
Right. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the most important things to think about when we think about these communities is that self-segregation is a response to disfranchisement and discrimination, and it's an inclusive process. These communities were inclusive to anyone who wanted to live there, all races and ethnicities. They became thought of as black or color or Negro towns at the time because they weren't predominantly white. But this is very different to something, say, like Jim Crow segregation, which is based on exclusion. And so I think one of the things I try to help people understand is that these communities were a response to other conditions so that they could have these opportunities, like you said, not just migration, but to be business owners, to be the postmaster, to be the mayor. I heard earlier you have a Black Mayors Association coming up. Mm-hmm. Many of those Black mayors will be Black mayors of historically Black towns. And certainly, 100 years ago, all Black mayors were mayors of historically Black towns.
You mentioned that although we call these Black towns, they weren't in all instances racially homogeneous, as the phrase suggests. And
right.
I know that, you know, there's another lesser-known history of black settling in Native American territories.
That's right.
You know, in Oklahoma, Florida, for example. Could you say more about that in terms of the coming together of these different racial and ethnic and cultural groups within black towns?
Mm-hmm. Sure. One reason that Oklahoma became a hotspot for these towns, were actually over 100 in the Oklahoma and Indian Territory, this is the height of it, is because the land itself had already been deemed in some ways as non-white land. It was already thought of as Indian land, so they didn't meet as much resistance there. Also, they were very clever, and they found ways to work around things. Some of the most interesting towns in Oklahoma were the result of African-American men from the South marrying Native American women who had land, and their union bringing forth, actually birthing a town One woman who founded with her husband the town of Tatum, Oklahoma, when she met him, she was a black Chickasaw woman. When she died, she was a community organizer, telephone operator, leader in her community, and she had all kinds of opportunities by this community building experience with the many people who came in later as well.
Your reference to this one woman who proved to be such a formidable leader in their autonomous community leads me to believe, obviously, there are so many black women leaders from this period that we really need to begin to highlight and become familiar with, as much as we are familiar with the Harriet Tubmans and the Coretta Scott Kings and so forth.
I'm excited to speak at the Southern Association of Women Historians conference next week in Fort Worth on this very topic, gender and the black town, because black women in these communities held positions, positions of leadership, business ownership, all kinds of things, long before that was happening in other parts of the country for African-American women. And they became sites of empowerment, gender-specific empowerment for them.
Incredible. Well, we're speaking about gender structures, and I'm also curious about the kinds of class structures that may have obtained in some of these towns. I mean, I'm sure they changed a lot over time, but I want to think that a community of newly liberated people, you would see more egalitarian societies, or at least since you had a lot of entrepreneurs in the more urbanized black towns, we might see some forms of cooperative economics going on. Have you unearthed any of this kind of information?
Yes, there was a sociologist from the University of Chicago, Moselle Hill, who later taught at Langston University, which is an HBCU in one of the, I call them HBTs, historically black towns, Langston. And he studied several black towns in the 1950s, and he discovered that their past included less class differences. Now, as they develop and you get black business leadership and civic leadership, there are distinct classes that do form, but the differences from the richest person to the poorest person in these communities are not as wide as what we see in other southern towns or towns across America, for that matter.
The fact that the inequalities, all kinds of social inequalities, were less in these towns really makes them all the more objects for us to uplift as models for alternative societies that we might adapt for contemporary use. Excavating these histories can open us up to alternative ways of imagining community institutions, not just economic ones, but, you know, I'm thinking, for example, some of the institutions that may have evolved around neighborhood security or criminal punishment, you know, where you have isolated communities of black folks under constant threat from whites, you must devise some creative forms of community self-defense, you know.
And their community building, this resource mobilization, they were experts at it. And I do believe there's a lot to learn from that. And again, I want to repeat, this is nonviolent resistance at a time that the circumstances of society were so volatile. And we kind of think of this dichotomy between Du Bois and Washington of ceaseless agitation or accommodation. And black towns sort of are another story in that, because by moving, by just simply leaving and doing what they did best, which is build community within a town, really supporting each other, it really worked well. People weren't lynched in black towns. Mm-hmm. They were not, there are a few isolated incidents of things, but overall, people were safe in these towns. My master's thesis is on one particular town in Oklahoma called Tatum, and I remember interviewing one woman who went to school in this little one-room schoolhouse in this black town. And I'd been studying a lot what education was like for other black Southerners at the time, the 20s and 30s. And she said the thing she was the most afraid of is that her school teacher went to church with her mother. And if she did anything at school, her mom was going to find out. This is not the typical story of what children are afraid of in predominantly white towns in the South.
So true.
It's a totally different environment.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Rhonda Ragsdale about her innovative multimedia web-based project, blacktownsproject.org. Now, Rhonda, I have to address the elephant in the room, which is that despite their great promise and achievement, a lot of these towns fizzled out. What accounts for the demise of so many black towns?
I want to say it's their success, because these towns and self-segregation in general, they were a response to very negative social conditions. As those social conditions slowly improved, African Americans in black towns began to migrate to black communities in multiracial towns. Also, the NAACP nationalized a strategy for fighting desegregation that gave, or fighting segregation, that gave them alternatives. Also, rural towns in general declined after the 1915 era or so. Social movements happen in waves. And in many ways, the towns have been looked at. Every book I've read practically ends with the failure of the town, the decline of the town. But a social movement is successful when it's not needed as much.
Mm-hmm.
So for the towns to decline and African Americans to feel that they could reintegrate into white society or a multiracial society, at least in some ways, shows the success of the towns.
As people frame these black towns as failed experiments,
right,
to be consigned to the dustbins of history, it's clear from the work that you're doing that we need to reframe the way we situate these histories and really
that's
bring them to life
as social movements. Yes,
so is that the ultimate goal for the website?
The ultimate goal for the website is to preserve the histories of the communities, to allow people the place to store photographs. They can send them to us, and we will place them on the town that they correspond with, and provide an archive that generations can enjoy for a very long time in the future. And it's all free, all open access. It's all available to the public, and that's exactly how we want it to be.
Well, thank you so much, Rhonda Ragsdale, for documenting these endangered cultural resources that it's urgent to preserve and continue to build upon. Rhonda Ragsdale is an associate professor of history at Lone Star College in Texas and the founder of the website blacktownsproject.org. Please come back, Rhonda, one of these
days. Anytime.
Great. And good luck at the conference.
Thanks so much.
All right. You're listening to Moving the Center. I'm Kali Asad Amen.
I ain't no perfect man, I'm trying to do the best that I can with what it is.